The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. The Nations League. Harry Maguire sees red. Jordan Pickford goes walkabout while Jack Grealish sits on the bench. What does it all mean? Does Maguire need a rest? Why has Southgate gone defensive? With Southgate out trending before the game, do fans need to calm down a little, or should he perhaps be a little bit more attacking? Project Big Picture is rejected unanimously by the Premier League despite being suggested by members of the Premier League. What does that all mean? And has Barry had enough time to develop a strong opinion on it? We'll find out how the WSL is going, look ahead to the Premier League fixture, and take you back to the first episode of this incarnation of the pod to find out conclusively if Wilson has been talking rubbish all this time. All that plus your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Barry Glendenning, hello.
Hello, Max, how are you?
Yeah, I'm all right. Have you developed any strong opinions about anything?
Not really, no.
Oh, okay, that's okay. You've got a niche, haven't you? You've got a brand, and that is Brand Barry. Jonathan Wilson, good morning.
Morning.
How are you?
I'm very well. I always hate not being first in this because I feel rude not asking you how you are, but I know how you are because you've just said that.
Yeah.
So in a polite way, I'm very well, and I'm hoping that what you said earlier remains true.
Okay. And from now on, would you like to be introduced always first?
I just feel there needs to be sort of like, people need to understand that kind of I am interested in how you are, but it just seems pointless me asking.
Okay.
Because it wastes time, very much
right.
Like...
It does.
This last 2 minutes.
Yeah. Jackie Oatley, do you care how I am, or you just want to get down to the football?
No, I care deeply how you are, and I'm glad to know that you seem to be okay, because we had a little preamble to this pod, which people probably don't think about when we just come on. They think that we're just saying hello for the first time, but actually, I know you're looking relatively well with quite rosy cheeks, and you look like you've had your
spinach in my morning smoothie. That's what I have. I have spent a lot of money on a new boiler, which... disappointingly coincided with stopping taking a lot of money from bookmakers. But, you know, you lose some, you lose some. Right, England 0, Denmark 1. England conceded a goal via a penalty and had a man sent off in the same match for the first time since 1998, England v Argentina in the World Cup. I've just stopped celebrating that Sol Campbell disallowed header. England had two red cards in a single game for the first time ever, or Reece James was sent off after the final whistle. For being angry with what I thought was a really annoying ref, but I think I'm biased. It all happened... Well, the main event of this game was Harry Maguire's red card, Barry. And I found it quite sad seeing him trudge off like that.
Yeah, look, anyone can get a red card and it's not the end of the world, but Harry can't do right for doing wrong at the moment, and his form is diabolical. For club and country, and he did look very sad as he trudged off the pitch and down the tunnel. I don't think he should have been in the team in the first place, but it's indicative of Gareth Southgate's apparent determination to crowbar in favourite players, whether they're playing well or not. See also Jordan Pickford. And at least now, Maguire will be forced to miss England's next game through suspension, and I would say that on the balance of things is probably a good thing for England and possibly for Harry Maguire.
Jackie, if you think back to the World Cup, he was kind of the sort of unlikely poster boy for England, wasn't he? Is he the same player? Is he worse, or is his form just worse, or is it this sort of this cliche that we like to build players up and then knock them down?
No, I don't agree with that at all. I think we'd like nothing more than to have a fully functioning whiz-bang England team playing at pace, tempo, organised at the back, scoring lots of goals, and there would be no criticism. But when you've got a player who's clearly out of form, both for a very large club that he plays for and a country which has a huge amount of scrutiny, then there is going to be the element of what has happened to him. And we know what happened in the summer. It was, I think it's fair to say, an error of judgment, his choice of holiday destination and where he went, putting him in that position. That's gone now, except that it hasn't, has it? It's still hanging over him. And I do have a lot of sympathy for Gareth Southgate, clearly a lot more than other people do, because he has to make these decisions. He wants to try to be loyal to the players who have served him well and who he needs, more to the point. It's not about retrospective loyalty. It's about ultimately trying to get the best out of his key players at major tournaments. That's what the manager's job is all about, not necessarily the Nations League. It's semi-competitive, you know, not friendlies at all. It's all about performing and ultimately trying to win trophies. So he's trying to get that balance between being loyal enough to his key players that they will repay that support and come back into form when they need to for the major tournaments, but also getting results and avoiding a huge amount of criticism. So I do have some sympathy with him. It didn't work. I'm trying to criticise Gareth Southgate for the performance generally, I think, is a bit pointless because they were down to 10 men for an hour. So Harry Maguire, yeah, he'll get plenty of support. And you just hope that that faith will be repaid at major tournaments, because that is what it's all about.
Jonathan, lots of people saying, I think he needs a break. I don't know. None of us know if what would be good for him right now.
Are you saying he should go on holiday, Max?
I'm not saying he should go on holiday, no, but thank you, Barry. Wilson?
Different players reacted to adversity in different ways. In some cases, being able to focus on football, I think, can take a player away from the issues of having off the field. Some people are overwhelmed by it, but the form that Maguire's been in for United this season, I think, was raising warning flags already. And he had a dreadful half hour last night. I think one of Southgate's strengths as a coach, and one of the reasons why the World Cup went relatively well, was he was able to create this sort of quasi-club environment. And it wasn't this sort of constant throughput of players. And I think trying to get the balance between loyalty to people who've served him well in the past while continuing to evolve the squad. And he has used an enormous number of players and people who were key parts of that World Cup squad, like Jesse Lingard and Dele Alli, are nowhere near it now. So it's not that he's sort of just stuck in 2018. But unfortunately, the two players who he has shown loyalty ended up costing him the game last night.
Mm. We'll get on to Pickford in a second. I mean, the first challenge was incredibly rash and no need to do it. The second, I can't remember who was speaking of who when they said he's got a first touch like a trampoline. But the touch from Maguire was sort of scintillatingly bad, that touch, wasn't it, before the second yellow card. Duncan Alexander writing, England red cards chronologically by first name also sounds like a bit from a David Peace book. Alan, Trevor Ray, David Paul, David Allen, David Wayne, Rob Wayne, Stephen, Raheem, Kyle, Harry, and then we've added Reese on the end because of Reese James. The penalty, I don't know if it was a penalty or not, but Barry, what's Jordan Pickford doing? It's like his FIFA controller just goes wrong sometimes.
Yeah, I'm not sure if it's a concentration thing. Sometimes he seems too pumped, and then other times it's as if he's completely lost focus and kind of forgotten what he's supposed to be there for, where he is and why he's there. He is also clearly out of form. I'm not sure how much longer Gareth Southgate can stick with him. It's quite the pickle, because there are clearly better goalkeepers available for England selection than Jordan Pickford, and he keeps making mistakes. So do you persevere and hope that he comes out of this bad patch, or do you stick with him and perhaps he makes some sort of blunder that ends up knocking England out of the World Cup? I just don't know.
England were okay with 11 men, and they weren't bad with 10 either. I'm sort of minded to agree with you, Jackie. There's no real point analysing it too forensically because it was 10 v 11, and you have to set up there to try and nick the game, right? And stay in the game and try and get something from it. But Jonathan, why is Southgate being so defensive? You think about these last four games, they have been a big difference from last year. You know, three at the back and two holding midfielders. What's his, you know, about tactics? What's he doing?
Well, I think it's totally understandable. And I was on after the last load of internationals and I made the same point. Last year, England played 10 games and scored 38 goals. So scoring goals isn't really a problem. You look at the players England have got, and okay, you need to organise them and you need to sort of to work on the cohesion. And we know that kind of at elite level now, those coordinated attacking moves are vital. But fundamentally, England have got a glut of really, really good creative players. And the Grealish issue is part of that. That it's, you know, Grealish having been brilliant against Wales doesn't get in the team. But if you put him in the team, it would mean leaving out Mason Mount, who'd scored the winner against Belgium, or leaving out Marcus Rashford, probably leaving out Rashford because you want Grealish playing on the left. So having scored 38 goals last year, but looked vulnerable, particularly in the game against the Netherlands and that game away against the Czech Republic, which were the two defeats, it appears Southgate's thought, right, I need to kind of get some solidity back. We can't be this open if we're going to win a major tournament. So he's gone back to the back three. And you look at the five games he's going to play this year, they've only conceded two goals, both penalties, one of which I think was not a penalty. In terms of developing a solidity, that makes sense. The problem is, England got a problem at centre-back. Playing three of them means that players who are in, you know, better form don't get in. And perhaps England become a little bit static. But I think one of the reasons why that 3-4-2-1 or 3-4-3 works and why it's good, particularly for international teams, is it does give you that very simple base of three defenders, two sitting in front, and that's a good solid unit that's very hard to break down. If you can add to that the sort of creativity that you should have from the players England have got, then it might not be as attractive as England were at times last year, but it probably makes them more likely to win a major tournament.
Jackie, if you're going to play a three at the back, surely you play Tyrone Minks on the left because he's got a left foot, and surely you play Connor Cody in the middle because that's what he does.
Absolutely, and that's why it's slightly surprising that Dier played instead of Cody in the last game. But I guess it's a case of... It is way more difficult for Gareth Southgate than for the rest of us sitting on sofas going, it should be picking Grealish, he should be doing this, he should be doing that. He has to weigh up all these things. He's got managers in his ears telling him, don't overload him with minutes, don't overload him with minutes. He's got the situation with missing players due to COVID, due to ill discipline, the likes of Ben Chilwell as well, what happened there, and Tammy Abraham. He could have done without all that. So there's way more for him to weigh up than just for us. But I think... You could argue I'm slightly biased here, and I'm not, but I just do happen to watch every single minute that Connor Cody plays. Basically, I think he could solve some of Gareth Southgate's problems, because if Jordan Pickford continues to make errors, Pickford really is in goal because of his distribution, not because he's a better goalkeeper than Nick Pope, but he has far superior distribution. So if Pickford were to let England down, he wasn't great, was he, last night, made an error... If you were to be erratic, you could play Pope, knowing that you've got Connor Cody at the centre of the back three. His distribution is absolutely outstanding. He can defend, he can organise, he can marshal. He's a proper a team organiser. And I think, as Jonathan says, it's a real platform having that back three, stroke back five. And then you need your attacking players to really sink. And I think the reason he didn't pick Grealish, and people were screaming at him to pick Grealish or at least bring him off the bench, he mentioned because of pace. He wanted to be able to get up the field more quickly, and I think that's why Mount had the edge on him. But Grealish will have a role to play. It's just that he has other factors to consider. And I like the back three, and I think it can provide a lot of options for England. And they do have an abundance of options when those players are fit and available and not in COVID times when you've got all this craziness going on.
Well, the other point about Mount, I think... And I don't know to what extent Southgate was wary of picking players in all three games, which I presume is why Cody didn't play on Sunday. Sunday, the first half, certainly the first half hour of the first half, was a little bit shambolic. Lukaku was dominant. And you know, I'd been very... The thing I was critical of Southgate for during the World Cup was, I think, tactically got a few things wrong. I think against Colombia, he invited pressure needlessly. I think he was slow to react in the Croatia game to the fact England had lost control of midfield. But here, by pushing the wing back slightly higher and pulling Mount slightly deeper, so Mount was playing much, much deeper than Rashford on Sunday, he sorted out that balance midfield and he cut off a supply to Lukaku. So Mount has done that job. He's got that right. So to then sort of take him out and bring Grealish in when he's seen a problem, he's analysed it and he's found a solution that involves Mount, I think it makes complete sense you stick with Mount. So it's unfortunate for Grealish, but it's great that England have got these options. And then, you know, the question about why he didn't come off the bench. The issue of pace. But also, in those last sort of 10 minutes when Calvert-Lewin came on, England were going long because that was the only way they were going to... that was the way they're going to put pressure on Denmark. So you want somebody, you want a second sort of focal point. So Calvert-Lewin on that sort of left side tucking in role as a target man, makes more sense than Grealish. Whether you could have brought Grealish on for one of the two central midfielders, perhaps, but...
Wasn't it a lovely moment, very 90s, very late 80s, 90s, just to see Pickford just knocking, smashing it as far as he could, and having two big centre-forwards just trying to get a free kick or something. That's the football that I would pay to see. Matt says, I'd just like to hear a good 10 minutes devoted to Max's views on England playing at Wembley in their blue away kit, while Denmark also played in their away kit, which is white. Yeah, we basically watched Iceland lose 1-0 to Poland last night, didn't we? Kieran Trippier wasn't available. He had to attend a Football Association disciplinary hearing, perfectly timed on that day, to answer charges relating to the breaking of betting rules. Trippier was charged with several alleged breaches during July of last year, the same month he moved from Spurs to Atletico Madrid for $20 million. He has said that he did not place any bets himself or profit from bets made by other people. Elsewhere, the home nations, Wales won 1-0 in Bulgaria, a win without Bale and Ramsey. They're unbeaten in the last five competitive away games, the joint's longest unbeaten away run in their history. Having conceded a goal in over 10 hours of competitive football, Wales are top of their Nations League group with two games to come in November. That Johnny Williams goal, that finish, Jackie, is beautiful.
It was a double Williams, wasn't it? Nico Williams down the right and Johnny Williams finishing it off. And bless him, his first goal on his 25th cap. It had been a very long time coming and it meant the world to him. So, yeah, fair play to him and to Ryan Giggs, who's building something there. It's not the easiest job being the Wales manager. Only six of the 15 players that played were born in England. And he, although the Welsh people don't like it when you say that, do they? But yeah, it's a very, very difficult juggle for him. But it's exciting times, and it's and they've got a couple of home matches in November against the Republic of Ireland and Finland, and now tried to win the group to promotion to the top tier.
Johnny Williams said, there were times when I wondered if I'd ever be back in a Wales shirt a couple of years ago. I've had so many highs in a Wales shirt, but at club level, I've been knocked back quite a few times. Since I've been under the gaffer here for Wales, he's always given me a chance to play at this level. I'm just glad I can repay that faith. He's an interesting character, isn't he? And I think we, in Sunderland Till I Die, he was sort of one of the most interesting players that you saw, that, you know, he had a crisis of confidence and you know, injuries really set him back psychologically as well as physically.
Yeah, as the Man City song used to go, we're not really here. And he was in that documentary, but he was on loan at Sunderland, but he wasn't really there, because I think he spent most of his time in the treatment room, and it was clearly getting him down that they were having this terrible season and there wasn't much he could contribute to it. And he was very honest about his depression. Came across very, very well in that. So I do keep an eye out for him now, and like, it's nice to see him do well. He just came across as a really nice bloke.
Very quiet and sensitive soul, wasn't he? It was a great documentary, that. But first series, way better than the second, didn't you think? The second one was just all about the guy, the director. It was all about him and his hair.
And his red trousers.
Where was the substance? We wanted more players. We wanted more from the manager. It was so disappointing. I loved that first series.
I thought as well, the taxi driver and Luke 09, they came across amazingly well as well, didn't they?
Absolutely.
Scotland, Czech Republic. David McAlpine says, are Scotland now the favourites to win their Euro 2020 group if we qualify? Now that England appear to be self-imploding and we have the Czech Republic in our back pockets, I like that confidence. Ryan Fraser, been directly involved in six goals in his last eight starts for Scotland, two goals, four assists. Set up by Lyndon Dykes as well. Five games and two goals for him. They stole Lyndon Dykes from Australia. His elder sister won a gold medal for Australia in gymnastics in 2006. But a nice story. His parents were from Dumfries and he came over here and then signed for Queen of the South. I mean, should Scotland fans have reason for optimism, Barry?
Yes, absolutely. What is that? Seven, eight games unbeaten? Eight.
Eight.
That's very heartening. Steve Clarke seems to be doing a good job. They have... You know, it's no secret. Scotland have some excellent players, but they've a lot of them all play in the same position.
They're all left backs.
Yeah, they're all left backs. They're all central midfielders. But Lyndon Dykes and Ryan Fraser seem to be forging a good big man, little man partnership up front. And while I imagine Serbia will be favourites to win their playoff for Euro 2020. I don't think there's much there for Scotland to be afraid of in Serbia's three games in this break. They beat Norway, lost against Hungary, and drew with Turkey. And I think the most Scottish thing imaginable that could happen is they will beat Serbia, qualify for Euro 2020, and then the tournament will be cancelled.
That group, by the way, if the tournament happens, England, Croatia, playoff winner C, which is Scotland or Serbia, and the Czech Republic, Wilson.
Well, from both Wales and Scotland's point of view, topping these Nations League groups, I don't know if people have realised, I only realised this yesterday, it's not just about promotion, but in terms of World Cup qualification, the way qualifying works, there are 10 groups, half of which have 6 teams, half of which have 5 teams. The top teams, this is in UEFA, the top 10 teams qualify automatically. The next 10 go into playoffs with the 2 best Nations League group winners who haven't already qualified. And those 12 teams play off for the other 6 places, for 16 UEFA slots. So Scotland are ranked, I think they're in pot 3 of the seedings. So this is a sort of route to kind of circumvent having to finish in the top 2 of their group. So and Wales obviously would give them a fallback option as well. So the Nations League doesn't matter, but it does sort of matter in that sense.
Yeah, so for Scotland, it's all about that playoff with Serbia. For Northern Ireland, all about that playoff with Slovakia. They lost 1-0 in Norway. Ian Barraclough made 10 changes for this. They're bottom of their group, but it is this Slovakia game. A few Northern Ireland fans, Barry, were not happy with our review of their fantastic penalty shootout win against Bosnia-Herzegovina, mainly because most of the analysis was me talking about the ripped sleeves of Bailey Peacock Farrell's jersey and not actually their performance. But we have promised, you don't know this yet, Barry, but you will join me in this promise that we will rectify this after the playoffs. We may even move the pod kickoff to accommodate both Scotland and Northern Ireland's playoffs so we can do it justice.
I think we should just do a Northern Ireland special and get Kyle Lafferty on. Give us a potted history of everything we've missed out during our neglect.
We're going to get stick now for our review of that game against Norway, aren't we? But we'll do it properly after the playoffs. Your boys, Barry, they lost to Finland. Wilson, you enjoyed this game, didn't you?
Well, I've watched all 3 Ireland games in the last week, and my admiration for the people of Ireland has gone through the roof. How they watch that on a regular basis. I mean, it's no wonder they all watch the Premier League all the time.
Sorry, Johnson. This is Ireland playing free-flowing, expansive, attacking football. It used to be a lot worse.
Yeah, no, I mean, no, I'm being facetious. I have watched an awful lot of Ireland in recent years.
With the emphasis on the awful.
Yes. Yeah, I met Stephen Kenny at an event in Dublin a year ago in December, and I thought he was very impressive. I think what he's done, or what he did with the under-21s, was very impressive, and they obviously played some great football. And I think a change of approach is desperately necessary. And he's had awful luck in terms of losing players to various COVID things, and things have turned out not to be COVID things, but might have been COVID things. But they've scored 1 goal in 5 games under him now, and that's, I guess, a concern. And the other thing, which I just find unbelievable, is Mick McCarthy's on co-commentary all the time, which just seems so classless from him. You don't turn up and kind of immediately put pressure on your successor. And he's clearly, I mean, I presume he's not doing it deliberately, but he's very much emphasising his style of football. So every time anybody plays a long ball that comes off, he'd be like, that's the ball they had to play. And there's an amazing bit in the Slovakia game when Marek Hamšík plays a sort of a 40-yard diagonal pass. And he goes, see, that's the thing with Marek Hamšík. He's got all the skills, but he knows when to play a long diagonal when he needs to. Like, it's Marek Hamšík. Marek Hamšík's long diagonals are not the thing about Marek Hamšík. And so when James McLean had that chance in the first half of the game on against Slovakia, wasn't it? And he was sort of, well, that James is going to get chances for you like that. It's a ball bounced about in the box. That's not how you play football. So, yeah, I've got a lot of sympathy for Stephen Kenny, but this hasn't been a great start.
Well, it's a bit like when England failed to qualify for Euro 2008 and Steve McLaren went with 5 Live. There are a lot of England fans not too happy, but from Steve McLaren and 5 Live's point of view, he was very, very useful to have him around. So you can see Mick McCarthy certainly would not have thought of it in any kind of negative way. He just wants to be involved and enjoys doing his summarising. But I love Big Mick.
I really like it. I really like every time they play a side foot pass. No, knock it long there, lad. Hit the channels there, lad. Whenever, literally whenever. Anyway, also in the Nations League, Italy won, the Netherlands won, one for Van der Beek. Jota and Bernardo looking good for Portugal in a 3-0 win over Sweden. No Ronaldo, obviously, he's isolating at the moment. Germany 3, Switzerland 3 was a fun one, including a great slow-mo dink from Remo Freuler. Spain lost to Ukraine. And Josh says, after all the talk of boring nil-nils on Monday's pod, can we spend some time talking about the biggest nil-nil of the international break? Liechtenstein 0, San Marino 0. First non-loss for 40 games. First away clean sheet in their 30-year history. One win, four draws and 162 losses. Glorious. One other bit of international news. Neymar overtook R9 Ronaldo as Brazil's second highest scorer. Got a hat-trick in a 4-2 win over Peru in World Cup South America qualifiers. He's on 64 goals. Pelé is on 77. So he's got a little way to go.
Max, before these international breaks started, you asked on the pod, did I think it was a good idea that these internationals were being played? And I said no. Now that it's over, I see Jonathan has written an article about same. It was a really terrible idea to play these games.
Yeah, it really was. I mean, The COVID protocols had worked really well on a domestic level, at least in Western Europe. And then to suddenly just sort of toss them all in the air and let everybody mix. And, you know, who knows what the knock-on effects of... You know, Ronaldo tested positive very soon after that game against France. I don't know enough as to what the chances of having infected a France player are, but it's possible. And if they then go back to their clubs and that spreads out. So it wouldn't surprise me at all. I mean, New Zealand have already pulled out of the friendly against England next month. It wouldn't surprise me at all if we end up with a very curtailed international break next month.
To be fair, New Zealand only pulled out because Jack Grealish wasn't getting a game. That's what they said.
I mean, I think the playoffs for the Euros have to go ahead. But everything else you can probably postpone or cancel.
All right, well, that'll do for part one. Part two, we'll talk about the big picture, unframed. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. So more now on the big picture. David Heitner and Paul McInnes in the paper saying Liverpool and Manchester United have been forced into an embarrassing climb down over their push to reform English football after a tense meeting of the Premier League's 20 clubs on Wednesday. At the conference call, Everton's chief executive, Denise Barrett-Baxendale, demanded an apology from Liverpool and United, who were represented by Tom Werner and Ed Woodward. Werner and Woodward refused, feeling they had nothing to apologise for. They claimed to have merely discussing a list of ideas, which would eventually have been put forward for debate. This led to incredulity in some quarters. Significantly, the other members of the Big Six, Tottenham, Man City, Chelsea and Arsenal, are understood to have stayed silent, sort of head down, not looking at the screen, which was apparently surprising to some clubs on the call. The Premier League statement said all 20 Premier League clubs today unanimously agreed that Project Big Picture will not be endorsed or pursued by the Premier League or the FA. Further, Premier League shareholders agreed to work together as a 20-club collective on a strategic plan for the future structures and financing of English football, consulting with all stakeholders to ensure a vibrant, competitive and sustainable football pyramid. Wilson, thoughts?
Well, in the short term, this is a very good thing. I think Project Big Picture was appalling, and I'm slightly surprised by the way people have been prepared to sort of give it any time at all. When you, irrespective of the, you know, I understand there's an immediate need for money low down the pyramid, but to take that money and sacrifice everything else, just sort of say to the Big Six, you run everything from now on, you increase the tilt on the already deeply uneven playing field. I mean, I know I'm coming at this from a point of view of a Sunderland fan who believes Sunderland's place is not in League One, and this would guarantee Sunderland could never, ever get into the upper echelons of the Premier League ever again. And so maybe I am slightly biased from that point of view, but I would hope all teams have at somewhere deep in their soul some little acorn of hope that they could get up into the top six or top seven, and this would just stop that. So in terms of what football is and what football should be, it was one of the very few things I've ever read and felt slightly sick at the end of when the proposals first came out. I actually came to the conclusion I would rather, and I don't know how, Sunderland aren't as near the edge as many teams, but I would rather Sunderland cease to exist and came back in the lower levels of the Northern League as a team with dignity and a chance of climbing than accepting this. You know, I'd rather not live on my knees scrabbling under the table for crumbs that the grandees happen to toss us. So I'm delighted that it's been stopped, but there is clearly a need of finding a way of financing teams low down the pyramid.
Jackie, as a Wolves fan, you know, you were in that 14, you know, the sort of shit for you, everyone else will be okay set. I mean, that must have rankled a fair bit.
Yeah, but I try not to think about these things from a self-interested point of view, because football is so riddled with self-interest. And I think we all need to take a step back from what happens to our team and what's best for our team and look at the bigger picture. And that's frankly what the big six stroke top nine have not done. And that is clearly not good for English football. And we value English football primarily because of the pyramid structure that we have and because of the fact that every club matters. Now, it feels that that's less the case since the finances have become so starkly divided between the haves at the very top and the have-nots. But don't forget, the top six, so-called top six, by the way, are the ones who can generate so much more income anyway via their international partners. And as you were saying on your pod the other day, they don't even need the betting money. They can acquire sponsorship from other enormous companies. And so it is those who can't acquire that sort of money outside of TV deals who need to be looked after. And everybody needs to have a voice. And the idea that the focus should be on the so-called big six and that they're the special ones. I mean, think about Quality Street. Think about the purple one. They had this great idea that everybody likes the purple one with the caramel and the nut in the middle. So let's make a special purple one. And then you start buying those and you think, oh, they're not so special after all, are they? What about the orange cream and the coconut eclair? You need the orange cream and the coconut eclair for
actually, Jackie, I don't think you
big
do.
Purple one to be so special.
I think you could get rid of the toffee penny and no one would care.
You need them
at
in
all,
there, but like the bag of rebels. You need the coffee one to really value the lovely minstrels and the Maltesers. They are just as important as each other, and we shouldn't allow the idea of these owners who care very, very little, frankly, for the structure of what makes English football so great to get away with this nonsense.
There's actually, I mean, sorry, but where that analogy doesn't quite work in a way that's quite important is that the value of the big six is only exists because of their capacity to play other teams. So the best revel doesn't gain its value by the fact that it sort of competes with the coffee revel. And so, and what you've seen in across Europe, in Italy, in Spain, in Germany, in France, is the big teams coming to sort of get bored of winning their domestic league because it doesn't have any value anymore, because it's no achievement for PSG. PSG's annual income is nearly three times as much as Lyon, the second richest team in France. Of course we win the league. There's no point to it. And this is what this would have reified, you know, the big six being able to take a bigger and bigger chunk of the pie. So it's not just that you need the mix and that every team, every town should have its team and that team should matter. It's that the very value of a competition is derived from the fact that you have, you know, a number of teams who can all compete. And if you get rid of that competitiveness, you lose what makes the Premier League good.
I'm slightly suspicious that, you know, Liverpool and United have been discussing this for 3 years. They have one Zoom meeting where someone says, I don't like this. They're not going to give up on this. I mean, they don't have the power to change it, but this isn't going to go away, is my fear.
No, of course it isn't. And I'm kind of surprised that David and Paul described Liverpool and Manchester United's climb down as embarrassing, because I don't think it is at all embarrassing. I think they knew full well it would be laughed out of the Zoom meeting, but they've sowed the seed now. They've put their idea out there, and it can be tailored. So I'm not sure it is any kind of embarrassing climb down. I'd say this is fully what they expected to happen.
Now, a big part of this was how to bail out the EFL. Originally, there was going to be a £250 million... How would you describe it, Barry?
Well, I think a lot of people are labouring under the delusion it was just going to be a free money. But it was basically an advance on the 25% of future revenues they would be getting annually.
And now the offer consists of grants and interest-free loans totaling 50 million, on top of the 27.2 million solidarity payments already advanced to League One and League Two, making a total of 77.2 million. Nothing decided on the Championship yet. All 72 EFL clubs are meeting today, Thursday. I was listening, Jackie, to Andy Pilley, the owner of Fleetwood Town, mentioning all sorts of conditions the Premier League made on a similar offer, like no relegation if the games aren't all finished this season, rules on young players coming after Brexit, which would have a huge impact on academies. He also said, look, 10 to 12 clubs in the Football League could be in administration by the turn of the year. So I guess the question is, I guess I know the answer, but why is that offer, whether it be grants or free money or what, gone from 250 to 50?
Yeah, well, I mean, there's still a huge amount of talking to be done. And I think what needs to happen is that it needs to be open, transparent, which is clearly not the way this whole project, big picture or big stitch up, as it's been called, has gone about. And also the problem with it is that if we're not careful, you're going to have the people who are desperate now just ready to sign on the dotted line for cash now in whatever form it comes, and then later regretting it. And I spoke to somebody at a governing body yesterday who said one of the alarming things about this proposal is the fact that they're offering all this money now to EFL and clubs, and Rick Parry, of course, is going, yes, yes, this is great, let's get this money now because we desperately need it. But then if you give them that power, there's no guarantee that tomorrow they won't go, thanks very much, and cut them loose. And then that's not an ongoing proposition, and that they've already signed up to deal with the devil and have no control anymore. So it needs people like Denise Barrett-Baxendale at Everton and the likes of Susan Whelan at Leicester City to stand up and make a stand on these issues, to try to rid the game of self-interest, but just to have more of an open, transparent conversation about it and be honest about everyone's motives.
Now, in the small print for the big picture, women's football was mentioned. Let's discuss it a bit further with The Guardian's women's football correspondent, Susie Rack. Susie, how are you doing?
Hey, I'm good, thanks.
What did you make of what it said in there? £10 million to bail out the WSL and the Women's Championship, a commitment that a, quote, new independent league for the women's professional game will finally be developed and funded, and reportedly more than £50 million a year for the WSL Championship, Women's FA Cup and grassroots.
I mean, that sounds wonderful, doesn't it? Like, at the moment, the FA, I think in 2019, spent 11 or 19 million on women's football. So that's quite a big step up, and would be great if it wasn't in the context of the broader project big picture remit, I suppose, because, you know, everything that comes from the men's side, you know, you've got to wonder about the intentions on the women's side as well. The fact that the whole thing is being put forward by Liverpool and Man United is ridiculously ironic, given that Man United resisted having a women's team. The Glazers shut down the women's team when they took over in 2005, and then kind of finally relented to having a team in 2018. They have been good since then. Like, the team are doing really well. They're investing. They're taking it seriously. But it does feel like they've had to be kind of kicking and screaming to the table. And Liverpool, meanwhile, team was relegated at the end of last season based on points per game, whilst the men's team won the league for the first time in 30 years. So to have those two teams, who haven't exactly been shown to have the best intentions when it comes to women's football, putting forward these proposals feels a little untrustworthy in the nicest possible way. But yeah, like, in theory, great.
What's the idea of it being independent? Is that important?
I think it is. I've argued it for a while now that there's a case to be made for independence to the Women's Super League. Like, obviously the FA running it, you know, has been good to a certain extent in that they've taken responsibility for having banned women's football 50 years and have put quite a lot of effort sort of ideologically into rebuilding support for women's football, done a great job at bringing it to this point of profitability and getting all these big sponsors on board and giving it like the credibility that it sort of needed to be able to kind of pull itself towards professionalism. But you've sort of reached a point where you wonder if the FA can like take it further and really progress it if they can't kind of commit fully to it. They're always going to have their hand tied by all the other commitments they've got going on across the rest of the game. So, like, the idea of an independent body that can act solely in the interests of women's football, that every decision it makes is about building the league and the clubs and the game, feels like that could be a step forward. Obviously, you don't want women's football and the league to collapse. That's the fear. That happened twice in the States with the NWSL. But like, there's got to be a point at which there's some kind of handover and there is some kind of independence to the league that is able to say, we can go for this sponsorship deal, or we can go for these TV rights deals or whatever, because we're not like hamstrung by the, you know, all the different other financial commitments that the FA has got.
Sure. But that independence, I think when some people hear independence, they would hear a kind of split from, you know, a relationship between, say, Tottenham men and Tottenham women. And actually those combinations seem to be quite positive. If you look at Arsenal's advertising, you know, and having Aubameyang and Miedemar on the same shot, those, we're not talking about that sort of independence.
No, not at all. Like, more that the league would be run and owned by the clubs and, you know, have some independent board members and things, rather than being run by the FA. You know, the board in and of itself could probably exist in the same form that it exists now, just, you know, without the financial pressures that the FA has in other quarters, sort of holding it back. You know, with the pandemic and the cuts that have taken place across the FA, they have ring-fenced professional women's football, but they haven't been able to up their investment. You know, that's a problem. Whereas, you know, if you've got a board with, you know, all those clubs as a part of it, acting in the interests of the women's game, then you're going to be able to find different revenue streams and be quite inventive and creative about the way you run it. So, like, whether we're at a point of it being ready to go independent and being able to survive and be financially sustainable on its own is, you know, a big question. We might not be there yet, but the FA have done a great job to this point, and are, like, mostly, bar, you know, the few casualties here and there, done a decent job at kind of driving it towards professionalism and pushing clubs in the right direction. But, yeah, whether we're kind of at the step at which we go independent is another question.
How on the pitch, how is the WSL going?
Oh, brilliant. Yeah, it's a really exciting league at the moment, because you've got Everton in particular and Manchester United both really, really pushing the top three teams, Chelsea, City and Arsenal, kind of upsetting the little kind of big three, if you wanted to kind of compare it to the Premier League in any way, of the Women's Super League. So it's very, very exciting. You've got Everton now in the FA Cup final as well. And the games, despite a few big score lines early on, which I think were a little bit kind of teething problem me, are significantly more competitive than they were last season. You know, you had Brighton take points off of Chelsea. And yeah, there have been some really nice upsets along the way.
Susie, thanks for coming on.
No worries. Thanks for having me.
Total pleasure. Susie Rack, women's football correspondent. That'll do for part two. Part three, we'll look ahead to the Premier League fixtures, including the Merseyside derby. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. So the Premier League fixtures. Can the best team in the country win again, or will Liverpool get the points? Everton versus Liverpool at Goodison. And Wilson, this is an exciting one, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. In a sense, it's Everton's first proper test. And maybe they liked it while they had momentum of the start of the season. But, you know, it's a great way to start again after the international break. And I guess the scrutiny on Pickford is even greater now than it was before.
Elsewhere, Man City-Arsenal could be fun, couldn't it? Leicester-Villa, anything could happen in that one. And Spurs-West Ham, big questions about whether Gareth Bale will play. And do we know if David Moyes is coming back? Because it would be scripted perfectly if Moyes was there to see West Ham get beaten. But they're on good form, aren't they, West Ham? Chelsea, Southampton, Newcastle United, Sheffield United, Fulham, Palace, Brighton. Monday, West Brom, Burnley and Leeds, Wolves. Jackie, do you want a moment on Wolves since you're here?
Yes, please. I'll always take that. There's a little concern as we speak on Thursday morning about that game between Leeds and Wolves, bearing in mind that Cristiano Ronaldo tested positive the morning after he posted a photograph, a selfie photograph of him and the rest of the Portugal squad, which contained five Wolverhampton Wanderers players. Now, of course, they did all test negative, but as we know, symptoms can incubate and take a few days. So I was onto the Premier League straight away saying, what would be the scenario of this match potentially being postponed on Monday night? And it would be, it's highly unlikely to happen, by the way, highly unlikely, but they just need to have 14 fit players. And if there was a case of it was several players in a similar position or they really wanted to appeal, then the Premier League board would make that decision. But it's not likely to happen. But that is the danger of the situation in COVID times. And I saw the press conference with Nuno Espirito Santo after the last game. And he was absolutely terrified of the players going away on international duty. He doesn't agree with it. He thinks it's ridiculous. And the fact that he has no control over players mixing with different bubbles all over the world and then coming back and being tested on the Friday morning before the weekend match. So that's a concern for him. But the big issue with Wolves this season on the pitch has been midfield hasn't been working. Neves and Moutinho, too similar, too much sideways passing. Raul Jimenez scored a couple of goals, but he's been very isolated up front. And of course, he doesn't have Jota anymore. He's gone to Liverpool, although he was on the bench at the start of the season. And he needs to strike up a new partnership with Pedro Neto and Daniel Podence. So that is a work in progress and Nuno needs to put together his jigsaw pieces.
Elsewhere, Robbie Savage set to be head of football at Macclesfield Town's Phoenix club, Macclesfield FC. Former National League club have had their assets purchased by Robert Smethurst, a local businessman who plans to enter the club in the North West Counties League next season, play at Moss Rose, the Cheshire club's home for 129 years. Bury AFC, another Phoenix club, recently began their journey in the same division. After Bury went out of business and were thrown out of League One. Savage has been confirmed as part of the group who purchased the assets, will join a new board of directors as well as helping them assemble a team ready for the start of next season. So fair play to him. I've told John Bruin to get a tattoo of Robbie Savage's face. I think it's only right that John Bruin gets his face on his chest. Full size, I think. At @JohnBruin_ if you would like to tell John to get a tattoo of Robbie Savage's face on his stomach.
On the subject of Phoenix clubs, the Old Firm Derby is on Saturday lunchtime when Celtic entertain the Phoenix club that is Rangers. So that should be interesting. There's quite a large concern that loads of Celtic and Rangers fans are going to travel south of the border so they can go on the lash and watch the game in pubs, which they would not be allowed to do in Glasgow under the current restrictions.
So, yes, please don't do that. Stay at home and watch it with your bubble. Mark says, could football clubs have an orchestra play in the stands and then be allowed fans inside the stadium because they'd be watching an orchestral performance, which is currently allowed? Which is a great question. And Chris says, can we get a shout out for Stoke Gabriel FC down in the southwest? Played 10, lost 10, scored 22, conceded 122. That's a fantastic start to the season. And we had this a couple of weeks ago from Stephen Sheridan, who said, on Max's first ever pod as the new host of the Guardian Football Weekly discussing the mad heights transfer fees were reaching, Wilson compared it to the early 17th century Dutch tulip bubble. Max's take-home was, so the only way the transfer bubble will burst is a return of the Black Death. Wilson replied, well, in a way. In the light of the grim prescience of this discussion and the fact that so much has changed, yet massive transfer fees have persisted, should we conclude that Wilson's comparison was a load of guff? Let's play in the clip.
So you then get to the question of, are we in a bubble? So I compared it in a piece to the tulip situation in the Netherlands in the early 17th century. When, okay. Well, I actually think there's a better example. The tulip thing is people, these tulips got a blight, a mosaic blight. So they got marbled petals, which nobody had seen before. You had two colours on the same petal.
Did people react or badly to
the tulips? They went mad for it. Okay. The price of tulips just kept going up and up and up. 1604 it begins.
Okay.
And for 35 years, you have the church and the guilds going, this is madness, this can't last, this can't last. And then suddenly one day, 1639, in Harlem, there's this tulip market, nobody turns up. Now, there is some suggestion that it was because of an outbreak of plague, but the bottom falls out the market and loads of tulip merchants are bankrupted. Okay. I actually think
the only way the bubble in the Premier League will die is if the Black Death comes back.
That's certainly a way.
Okay.
Or Brexit, whichever's first.
Right.
I think the better example is the Indian horse market of the 17th century. 37.5% increase in TV rates. So that would imply the bubble will keep growing for this season, next season, and then three more years before there's any concern at all.
So, Wilson, we had to fade it down and up because you spent 10 minutes talking about tulips. But, you know, the conclusion from this is you suggested that actually if we did have some sort of global pandemic type thing, that transfer fees would be hit, and they haven't been, so...
Well, hang on, they have.
Oh, okay.
Everywhere apart from the Premier League, they've been hit.
All right. Don't yeah, the idea so that angry the, about it.
I'm not getting angry. I'm just giving you facts.
Okay.
And I mean, also, if we're dealing with facts, the bit you faded out there was where I acknowledged that the tulip analogy is not ideal, and the better analogy is the Indian horse market.
Yeah.
And if you go back, you can listen to me talking about why the price of horses went up in India as a result of colonialism and why the bottom fell out of that market when people stopped buying Arab thoroughbreds and started going for cheaper models. Anyway, everywhere outside the Premier League, transfer fees have plummeted. Oh, the idea that Neymar's record of 222 million euros is going to be matched anytime soon is, you know, it just won't be. So, and I think the Premier League, you might see it dipping in the next couple of years. So I think we were, and to be fair, you know, your first pod to come out with a call that big, I salute it that you correctly acknowledged that in the event of some kind of pandemic, like the Black Death or COVID, which we had never heard of at the time, the transfer fees would be affected. Hmm. And we even talked about bubbles, which I hadn't realised.
Yeah, we were, weren't we? Anyway, listen, I'd like to apologise for predicting a global pandemic. I hope it wasn't my fault. And it's pretty much all we have time for today. So a now disgraced Jonathan Wilson, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you, Barry.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Jackie.
Thank you.
We'll be back on Monday. Hey, Susie.
Hello.
She's just chomping on a big purple one at the moment, I think. Oh, that sounds rude.
Yeah, it did.
It sounded terribly. Sounded incredibly rude.
She's just chomping on a big purple. What a welcome.
That's how Jackie said hello to all of us, honestly.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.